This is an attempt to be pedagogical for things that probably, well, I'm going to talk about things that it's possible no one here works on. things like the really practical aspects of solving the many electron problem. So I'll mention some of these things that that other people do as sort of a motivation for what we're trying to do. So what I want to talk about is the many electron Schrödinger equation, which is really a major part of much of condensed matter physics, and also a piece of chemistry known as quantum chemistry. And basically, you're just trying to put down a set of nuclei and then find the solution to the Schrödinger equation for the electrons. And you use the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and so you don't you treat the nuclei as being classical. And so then, you know, what do you do? Okay, and see if I got this working. So I did not check with Giffre and find his axes, but I ended up with almost the, you know, one of my axes is almost the same as one of his axes. So so this bottom axis is what Giffre was calling, you know, useful and Disneyland or whatever. So we can classify the sorts of types of problems in this field. There are, on one axis, we have simple models. Think of like the Ising model, which is not supposed to mimic any particular material or system, but it's supposed to answer fundamental questions about like the existence of phase transitions. And then you go over to specific real systems where you want to try to get an answer that an experimentalist can use. On the vertical axis, there's another thing that happens to go along with these systems. You can think about systems that are weakly correlated versus strongly correlated. Okay, so the textbook systems that you see are mostly in this sort of easy corner, weakly correlated, very simple, like the ideal Fermi gas. Okay. And then we have problems which are, because of the strong correlation, are very hard, like what is the phase diagram of the Hubbard model that people, myself included, have been working on for a long time. But still, this is a simple model. The Hubbard model just has two parameters, and one just sets the energy scale. Okay. Okay, and an example of weakly correlated but specific real systems and questions. This would be like, what's the band gap of silicon, which you know, people have been trying to make their methods like density functional theory get right for a long time. It's not always, it's even though it's weakly correlated, there can still be difficulties. But that's a real specific question for a specific material. Okay, so this region has been sort of taken over by density functional theory. Density functional theory just works very well for this sort of weakly correlated but specific systems. And that sort of occurred in starting around the 80s. And this is a major part of condensed matter physics and chemistry. The paper that sort of most started it all, or a couple of papers, like there's a paper by Hohenberg and Cohn that has 40,000 citations, and it has some fundamental aspects of it which probably count for 1% of the citations, and almost everybody else is, oh, we use this method to solve a particular real system. Okay, so these are the most cited papers in the Physical Review. Okay, and then there are methods that sort of put in a better, they can treat somewhat more strongly correlated systems, a variety of types of methods used in quantum chemistry, and quantum, there, some of them are sort of perturbation theory based, or it may be you write down a variational wave function with sort of a motivation from perturbation theory. There's also various types of quantum Monte Carlo. There could be a third axis on the size of the system that you can treat. That's sort of implicit in here. Okay, so there are lots of different types of methods. Okay. And then up here in the sort of simple models, but very strongly correlated. So there's been some nice progress in this area in sort of the last 5 or 10 years, much of it due to things that are tensor network related, say DMRG and PEPS. And so the many, some of us are involved in Simon's collaborations. The Mini Electron collaboration has been involved in trying to sort out what the real answers are for the phase diagram of the simple Hubbard model with you know, just the two parameters. And we've made a lot of progress, mostly coming from taking various methods that have uncontrolled approximations, but you think they're good approximations, but you don't have a, you know, you don't have a strict control over them, and comparing them and seeing, oh yeah, they agree. And if you have four methods, each of which is uncontrolled, but good, and you see that they all agree, then you have a lot of confidence. And so that's what the Mini Electron collaboration is, and there's you know, interesting results on the phase diagram of the Hubbard model. Okay. So here's a question which we would really like to know. You know, we have experimental results for the transition temperature of this high temperature superconductor, YBCO. Can we predict that theoretically? And up here we have nothing. You know, this is just sort of beyond what we can do. Okay, so we would like to push all of these sorts of methods. Lots of people are sort of interested in sort of going out to this corner. You know, people in these weakly correlated things keep, have, you know, been pushing them towards strong correlation for a long time. And up here, we're sort of realizing that, you know, once you've answered the Hubbard model, the phase diagram that you get are complicated enough that you realize that there's a lot that you just can't say about real materials. You need to know more about, like, if there's an effective Hamiltonian that's realistic, you know, what are its terms? Okay, so people are pushing in this direction. Okay, so if you want to push in this direction, besides the method itself, say DMRG or some other tensor network method, then the most important aspect of treating real systems is the treatment of the continuum degrees of freedom of the Schrodinger equation. So do you discretize the Schrodinger equation? Almost all of the methods do, except there's one notable one, diffusion quantum Monte Carlo, that has the electrons move around in real space, so they don't have to discretize it. Everybody else has to discretize it in some fashion. And this turns sort of, how do you do this? How do you do this effectively? And so this is something that this field has worked on for decades, and the problem is still not solved. There are very good solutions for particular types of things, but if in particular we want to know how to discretize the Schrodinger equation to make it good for tensor networks, to say to set up a PEPS calculation, that we don't know how to do that. And so that's sort of the subject of this talk is, you know, how do we think about this, and what progress can we make towards setting this up? And I want to sort of try to convince you that, you know, this aspect, seems like the more trivial part of the problem. You know, it's not really about the many electron aspects of, say, or many particle aspects of tensor networks, but it sets up the problem in an important enough way that it's extremely important to get it right. Okay. So the many electron Hamiltonian is shown here. We just have the kinetic energy. We have a set of nuclei. A goes over atoms at positions R, and so we have the Coulomb interaction with the nuclei, and we have the electron-electron interaction. We use atomic units, and so the basic unit is a Hartree, which is 27.2 eV, and the desired energy scale is a milli-Hartree. And so that's a factor of 1,000 in accuracy that you're, you know, even in the simplest system is sort of what you're shooting for. And energy differences are probably the most important quantity for many of these calculations. For much of physics, we don't really think of energies as being so crucial. But you're looking at like spectroscopic quantities that show a transition from one energy level to another. So you need those energy differences very accurately to connect with experiments. You're looking at binding energy curves. And so you need these energy differences to come out very accurately. So total energies don't matter so much, except when you have to subtract them and to get the energy differences. Good. Okay, so what are the biggest energies in the problem? So I learned as a graduate student to think about this from a renormalization group point of view, but not really with all the machinery of the renormalization group. So the sort of philosophy that I learned from Ken Wilson was first you want to identify the biggest energy terms in your Hamiltonian, and then you want to successively integrate them out to get a new effective Hamiltonian or Lagrangian. And if you have universality because you're working with a critical system with scale invariance, then universality can mean that you can often make do this integration out sort of poorly, and things will be universal, and so you don't have to worry about it. If we want to apply these ideas to a problem where we're trying to get real answers, then you can't do a sloppy job in your integration out. You have to do it accurately. And so this was sort of ideas in my thesis as a graduate student. And we had this paper, which is one of my least cited papers because in the end things didn't work, but it was talking about these ideas for thinking about the renormalization group for doing electronic structure. And this was something that Wilson thought about for a long time, although nothing that he sort of worked on really bore fruit. But I'll show you another example of sort of a forgotten Wilson paper on this that's very interesting, although it sort of has been passed by also. Okay, so what are the biggest energies in the problem? First of all, we have nuclear cusps. So the wave function, think of a 1s hydrogen orbital. The wave function is non-analytic at the nucleus, and the interaction diverges as your electron coordinate goes to the nucleus. Besides just the cusp itself, the core electrons in a bigger atom, the energy of the 1s level will go as the nuclear charge squared. And you integrate that up, and it falls off fast with the electron quantum numbers, and it integrates up to z to the 7/3, at least in the Thomas-Fermi approximation. This is a big energy. So one of the things that you realize, it's important to sort of integrate things out. You want to integrate out this sort of core electron stuff, because if you're going to subtract energy differences, this z squared can easily give you a factor of, say, 1,000. So if you want to do all of the energies accurately and get another factor of 1,000 from the energy scale, you may have to get everything accurate to a part in a million. Whereas if you just sort of integrate out the cores and say you've got an effective problem, then you only have this factor of 1,000. Okay? So that's sort of one aspect of the RG ideas that come in. And of course, without thinking about RG, then the people in this field realized this very early. Okay, next we have the electron-electron divergence. So we have, as we fix one electron coordinate, R2, and we move R1 across, and the interaction diverges. And the wave function, think of it as first quantized, fix all the particle coordinates except, think about two, and then one of them we fix here. And then the second, or the first coordinate comes along, and it has a dip like an upside down hydrogen atom function, a little dimple, but it doesn't send it all the way to zero. And so it's actually a rather mild dimple. And so there are many approaches that can actually do a reasonable job just by totally ignoring this singularity in the wave function. But if you really want to get it to sort of the high accuracy, you have to deal with this non-analytic behavior, which occurs everywhere, every physical location in your system, because two electrons can come together at any particular point. Okay, so that means that if you just think about somehow discretizing space, mostly you'll just sort of overlook this. Okay. And then the final things that we're interested in are these intermediate scale electron-electron correlation effects. You know, two electrons see each other, and the dimple may not matter, but they see each other. There's strong correlation effects at the level of the size of an atom or nearest neighbor atoms, and those are where a lot of the physics is, and we want to get that right. Okay, any question about this setup? Okay. So we want to discretize this problem. And so the basis set discretization is the most broadly used approach. What we do is we define a set of single, so functions in three dimensions, phi j. And then we define our field operators, redefine them in discrete fashion as these cjs that create an electron or destroy an electron in this particular orbital or this particular basis function. And we rewrite our Hamiltonian. and so that discretizes it. I'll show you an example where we write down some functions that we want to use, but they're not orthonormal. And so then we have to orthogonalize them. So you do an overlap between these functions and make the matrix. And then there's lots of ways to orthogonalize functions, but this symmetric way of doing it with the inverse square root of the overlap matrix is a widely used one that's convenient.
Steve,
yeah.
Why did you start with a set of functions that was not orthogonal if you were going to orthogonal?
Yeah, so when you do the Gaussians, there's reasons to choose them that are very compelling. So you put up with the non-orthogonality, but I'll say a lot more about that. Yeah.
This discretization is also motivated by underlying lattice.
Yeah.
Rather than what the quantum chemist will worry about. Suppose he wants to hydrogen molecule.
Right.
His discretization will be very different from.
Well, you can, for instance, set basis functions that live on each atom, and that would be very reasonable to do both for a solid and for a small molecule. Then you can have my other example is plane waves, which don't know about where any thing lives. But I'll touch on that too. Okay, so your discretized Hamiltonian looks like this. The Tij encodes the kinetic energy and the nuclear electron potential, and then the electron-electron interaction looks like this, notably with these four indices on the interactions that add quite a bit of complication to this basis set approach. Okay, so one broadly used one are plane waves. They're just what you think you are. These are particularly useful for a periodic lattice, and so you just put a box around a unit cell of your system, or maybe some copies of the unit cell, and use periodic boundary conditions. And so that's ideal if your system is periodic and extending off to infinity. It's not so useful for molecules. And I'm sort of thinking, I'm thinking about molecules quite a bit because it's sort of it's an easier step than a full periodic solid for, say, tensor network methods. So if you do it for isolated molecules, you sort of have images of your own system, and it's not so ideal. Okay, you cut off the plane waves just with some maximum kinetic energy, and then plane waves are sort of ideal for completeness for representing smooth analytic functions without any big difference in resolution from one place to another. They just do that sort of with the minimal possible number of functions. And so that makes them very useful in certain circumstances. But we have this nuclear cusp and maybe core electrons. And that's very non-analytic. And plane waves are terrible at representing that. And so what people normally do is pseudopotentials, which really are sort of at the embodiment of part of the RGI idea of integrating out the core. So a pseudopotential is, you solve the one atom problem. And if we're just trying to sort of get rid of the nuclear cusp of, say, hydrogen, you have this 1 over R interaction. But if you make it a little bit wider, if you replace the potential with something that's a little bit wider farther out and rounds out and makes it analytic, then you can get essentially the same solution to the Schrodinger equation in sort of the farther out region. And so that's the idea of a pseudo potential. It's done by sort of solving the Schrodinger equation a couple times on an atom. And it sort of is one way of thinking about integrating out the core. Okay, so this is sort of mandatory with the plane waves. So if you think about this area that sort of took over the weakly correlated systems, you can also think about the density functional method as something that integrates out the electron-electron cusp through a certain approximation. It gives you a mean field approximation in the end. But one way that you can think about it, which is not at all the way they usually talk about it, but we have very accurate results from, say, quantum Monte Carlo for uniform electron interacting electron gas systems. And this is a way of interpolating this data through use of a functional in to do non-uniform systems. And so it really relies on this being accurate, and that's sort of a good source of its usefulness. Okay. Okay, so suppose we wanted to try plane waves with a tensor network method. What about the area law? Well, you can set up you can set up the degrees of freedom, say in a one-dimensional system, just by listing the modes for each k, and you can say this particular k state associated with this C dagger k can be occupied or empty. And so the free electron gas, just your Fermi sphere, is a product state in this representation, just a bunch of ones for the things inside the Fermi sphere and zeros outside. Okay, so you might think, oh, this is great. Why don't I start with something which in some weakly interacting limit is a product state? That's great. And if the electron-electron interaction were weak enough, then you might hope that this plane wave basis would still be useful for things like tensor networks. However, the area law, which is the basis for most of the usefulness of our tensor networks, is formulated in real space, not k-space. And there is no area law for plane waves. If you think about the interaction, the two-electron interaction in k-space, it involves scattering of two particles that in this k-space lattice, the particles can be arbitrarily far away. And then they scatter to two other points, which are also arbitrarily sort of unrelated in this space to where you started. Okay, so that's drastic non-locality, and so you get volume law in this. And so you can test this sort of idea on the Hubbard model, a sort of simpler context. Try this k-space discretization, and think about this regime where the interaction is very small, and see if there's any regime where it's useful. And the answer is very disappointing, that the volume law kicks in very quickly, and you just can't compete with real space. Okay? So this idea of this sort of type of discretization is not the place that you want to start for thinking about tensor networks. Okay, so another type of, one of the earliest types of approaches was to write down basis functions, which were, say, just the Schrodinger equation solutions for hydrogen. And put them on, say you had two hydrogens interacting, and you just write down the 1s hydrogen orbital e to the minus absolute value of r. You write it down twice, and then that's non-orthogonal. So this is an example where you have to deal with the non-orthogonality, but you have a very good reason for doing that. Okay, so here's an example. So this is a very efficient representation. If you add several different functions up the hydrogen atom wave function chain, you do very well with, say, on the order of 10 functions per atom, is just sort of throwing out an order of magnitude. Okay, so then you need to work with this. So if you have n basis functions, you need to do this orthogonalization and all this procedure. But this VIJKL piece has end of the fourth terms in it. And each one is a result of an integral, should be sort of trivial. But these are six-dimensional integrals over two electron coordinates. And you may have a billion two-electron integrals, each six-dimensional. That's not an easy computational problem to do. And the exponential integrals are not analytic. So this is you know, people have used this, but it's got a lot of reasons to think it's sort of impractical. Okay, so what Gaussians are is people realize that you can approximate, say, e to the minus absolute value of x as a sum of a few Gaussians. So here's this e to the minus absolute value of x, and here's, say, three Gaussians, and they have different widths, and we sum them up with precisely adapted coefficients, and you get some sort of reasonable approximation here. It's not a great approximation, but one thing going for you is that it makes an error in the wave function, and if you're doing a variational calculation, that error gets squared. So you don't have to fit this so perfectly, because the error gets squared in the things that are usually done. So more generally, they can do these terms that can represent the higher angular momentum functions by proper choices of the exponents a, b, and c, integers, you can do a good representation of, say, all the hydrogen atom wave functions, and so this is the Gaussian basis set that is the input to most of quantum chemistry, and also some solid stuff. And Gaussians, even the two electron integrals, the six dimensional one, you can do them analytically, and they can do them very fast. And some analytic formulas actually take a while to evaluate, they can do that all fast. They can do a billion of them, you know, in say a minute or so. And this sets things up. So that's, you hear about, you know, in this field, Gaussian basis sets, but you should sort of think of them as just sort of like, oh, atomic atom-centered things. When you set them on an atom, using exactly the same basis function centered on an atom, this allows the energy errors that you make at the core to cancel. So this sort of incorporates RG ideas too. It's like, okay, if you're keeping the core and you do energy subtractions, you may have this huge error, but this is a way of making it precisely cancel. So with this sort of approach, you don't even need pseudo-potentials, because you're sort of doing the exact same treatment for each atom, no matter how they move around. Okay, so this is the fairly standard basis for molecules, and a lot of methods start with a Hartree-Fock mean field calculation to sort of get the best single electron sort of product state that solves this system approximately, and then that ignores interactions that you may in some systems look weak in terms based starting from the Hartree-Fock theory, so you can have various approximations that sort of start with perturbation theory itself, or they may have a wave function ansatz that's based on perturbation theory. Okay. And so there's lots of these methods. So what about tensor networks from this point of view? Well, the Hartree-Fock state is, again, a product state. You have some Hartree-Fock orbitals that get filled up, and then others that are empty. And so it's it looks like a plane wave. And so you can apply DMRG just by choosing an ordering for these orbitals. And then the worst you can do is reproducing Hartree-Fock. Okay, so that's a useful method. For small molecules, this DMRG is extremely efficient, aside from sort of area law aspects, it's just an efficient method. And so this is useful. But the Hartree-Fock orbitals are extended across the system. You don't have the area law. And so if you start to scale up the size of your system, it just starts to fall apart, volume law stuff. So a better setup is you can sort of have your cake and eat it too. You can rotate all the orbitals within the Hartree-Fock occupied space. The occupied space, all the filled ones, you can do a unitary transformation that keeps, so they're all occupied, so that doesn't change, but you can try to make them as localized as possible, and then separately localize the unoccupied space. And so you can try to get your, product state Hartree-Fock plus area law as much as possible. Okay, and so this is the most useful version of this quantum chemistry DMRG, and Garnet Chan, who couldn't come to the conference, is our quantum chemist in the many electron collaboration, who has done all sorts of nice things. But this was an example of a very nice application to to something involved, a complicated model with strongly correlated atoms that's involved in photosynthesis. That they, and they got this paper in Science magazine. Okay, so what are problems with this approach? So we have tensor networks applied to this problem, but there's problems. So so first of all, back to the area law. How localized can you make this basis? And the unfortunately, often you can't make it very localized. And as a simple numerical test in 1D, I did this little calculation, which what this does was it set up a grid of 1D Gaussians, which overlap. And the green curve and the blue curve are two of those, but there's a whole grid of them. And so they overlap enough so that they have a high degree of completeness for smooth functions. But then you do the overlap matrix and you orthogonalize them. And one of the orthogonal functions is this red curve, which and then you localize among those functions. And that's the most localized this can get. And so it has all these oscillations that extend out that are an artifact of this orthogonalization. And so then you really start to worry about the area law. It's like you tried to localize this thing and sort of roughly it's localized, but you have these tails that go out throughout the system. And what about, you know, your area law? These calculations can really get bogged down as you make the system bigger. Okay, yeah.
Why is it so important to orthogonalize
them? Garnet has done one attempt at working, say, with DMRG in a non-orthogonal basis, and the system, it just wasn't too useful. So we don't have any technology to make this work without it, without the orthogonalization. You know, there's been an attempt, and it didn't really work. So maybe there's a way, but we don't know it. Okay, so we don't know how much the non-localization increases entanglement. It's sort of, you know, depends on the strength of the interaction. Certainly for a strong local interactions, you think it would hurt a lot. Another aspect, which is purely computational, the two electron interaction has these end of the fourth terms with this big VIJKL. And that's very costly. And if the basis were completely localized, so that you think now, say, in terms of a grid, this is really just a density-density interaction between grid points, it would drop to n squared. And so we're paying a very high price for this basis set formulation that makes, and you know, even if the functions were somewhat localized to start with, the orthogonalization makes them delocalized, and so you have these very bad scaling. Okay, so the very best that they can do with this has about 100 to 200 basis functions. You can do medium molecules, but not as big as we'd like. Okay, so now let's think about discretizing on a grid. So we've been doing this for a while for sort of toy model 1D continuum systems. And the motivation for this was to try to understand sort of where density functional theory works and fails by having some exact results for toy systems, which are, you know, in 1D. You don't want 1 over x, it's too divergent at short distances, so you can smooth it out just by altering it. There's other choices. So then you discretize the Hamiltonian just by putting it on a grid with, say, 20 grid points per atom. And then we can use DMRG. We essentially do make a matrix product state with putting one of the tensors on every grid point. And then say we have a nucleus here, another one there, another one there. And we have this long system. And we can just turn on all the DMRG machinery for that. And it took a lot of work, particularly by Miles, to make this work. But you can make this work for quite large 1D systems. This is an example with 100, we call them pseudo-hydrogen atoms. And it's showing a comparison. The bottom results are for density functional theory, and the top is for the pseudo-exact DMRG. And there's two curves here. One just is a shifted one, so you can see how much it varies near the edge of the system. This is the blue curve, that's the edge of the system. And so we get this density that, you know, each peak is just where one of these nuclei are. And so we can get this very accurately and compare with other methods. Okay, now one of the key aspects of this is that the calculational cost is linear in the number of atoms, and a key aspect of that is a compression of the matrix product state, which people have worked on in here, and we've worked on some more recently, and Miles will, I hope, tell us more about that. Okay, yeah, he's nodding. You see so many talks where say, so-and-so will tell you about this, and the guy just says, no, no. So, yeah. Okay, so that's an important thing. Linear scaling is sort of a big goal in this whole sort of thing, which is usually the assumptions to get it linear in most of these methods are very drastic. Okay, so could we do this sort of grid for 3D electronic structure? You know, you like lattice gauge theory, you say, well, that's 4D. We only have to do a grid in 3D, that's easier. Can we do that? Can we just put down a grid and put down nuclei and do PEPs, right? So that's a dream. And I think that's a useful dream to think about as sort of, you know, that's, you know, if we could really do all of that stuff, that would really be a nice method. But how far away are we from that? The main thing that you see from this is that a naive putting down of a grid has way too many points to be practical for our current computers. So you might have, say, on the order of a billion points. And the key thing is that the grid spacing is set by the nuclei, so a naive discretization would have a 1 over z spacing. But an advantage of this is that the interactions are of this simpler density form, so they only scale as n squared. You might hope to compress that. Okay, so it starts looking a little bit better, but still so many points. What about PEPs? Is that ready for 3D? Well, nobody's done it, but at least people like Philippe Corbeau are starting, you know, they'll answer questions about it. They're starting to think about it. I'm sort of optimistic that maybe something could be done here. Okay, so I'm going to take that point of view and then say, okay, how could we set up the calculation for a 3D PEPs? Okay, so here's the key point. Is there a much smarter way to build a grid Hamiltonian? Something with this sort of order n squared terms like the grid, but with a big grid spacing, say, you know, just a couple of grid points per atom, okay? Because you've done something very clever. You've integrated out the cores, et cetera. There's an electron-electron cusp that, you know, has stuff going on below the grid size. Well, hopefully you've integrated that out too and built it into the effective Hamiltonian for this sort of ideal coarse grid. Okay, and then if you were going to imagine either PEPs or DMRG or some other tensor network, that would be sort of an ideal setup to do. Okay, so can we try to progress towards this? Okay, so there's a couple of ideas. So is there a way of combining grids and basis sets? Each has some advantages. And then is there a sort of RG motivated approach, which was sort of this early paper with during my thesis was sort of pushing in that direction. Okay, so one piece of progress, which is actually a very nice piece of project, Miles is going to talk about this afternoon. This combines grids and basis functions in an easy way. It just uses different axes with different approaches. So this is a sliced basis set approach, where in one direction, and we imagine a long chain system, and all we've done are hydrogen atoms in a line, but they're real 3D hydrogen atoms. And along the long direction, we make it a grid. And then in the transverse directions, we use a few basis functions and orthogonalize them and use the basis set technology. So this nicely obeys the area law, because in one direction, we're doing a sharply defined thing. And so nothing to interfere with the, you know, it's only when you cross the boundary that you worry about the area law. So this obeys the area law, and we can compress it. And so we've been able to scale this up and get, just with these, you know, purely 1D grid calculations, get computation times that scale linearly with the number of atoms. And so here's this inner plot is the time for one DMRG sweep in seconds. You know, so up here it's around an hour. And this is going up to 1,000 real 3D hydrogen atoms. Okay, so we're very excited about this, and Miles will tell you about this. And this is just a plot of the electron density.
Sorry, this basis states are not centered around the nuclei.
They are.
I see.
Yeah.
Sorry, Cliff, I didn't understand. The basis set are two-dimensional, right?
Yeah. Two-dimensional basis sets. So we project the three-dimensional basis sets that the quantum chemists use onto two dimensions. And you know, then the projection is different depending on whether you're sitting on top of a nucleus or sort of in between. In between, they're very, you know, you don't need the sharp parts.
So these are not the sets you would use in two dimensions?
And so they're smaller than in two dimensions. Not a lot smaller, but smaller. Yeah, but Miles will tell you all about that. Okay, so I want to think sort of, again, with a sort of big picture, maybe we can do this sometime in the future, think about this more 3D problem. So can we combine grids and basis sets just along one direction? And the main idea is to, instead, you have a grid here, but you attach a basis function to each grid point with something that looks like this. So these functions are actually useful grid functions. They're orthogonal. That's why they have these wiggles. But they're very localized, unlike the thing you get from the orthogonalizing directly. They just decay very rapidly. And so you can change a grid problem into a basis set problem just by describing the grid points with these functions. Okay. A key advantage for this would be, for instance, if you have some singular behavior, you can just add it to the basis and orthogonalize just that piece and deal with the singularity in a really simple way. Okay. So how can we do this? It turns out, you know, this problem was a hard problem to took decades to sort of figure out how to do this. So you know, if you don't have the orthogonality, you could just make them all Gaussians, but that has the ideal sort of locality in real and momentum space, but it doesn't have any orthogonality. So combining this systematic completeness, orthogonality, locality in both real and momentum space, that was what was hard. And it turns out that Wilson worked on this problem and thought pretty hard about it and did a key early work, which has sort of mostly been forgotten. Okay, so this is Wilson's Wannier functions. Really a terrible name for a paper. People thought it was something totally different from what it was that I think had a big impact on it never getting published. But he was essentially trying to find those functions that I put on the grid in the previous slide. And so he developed a method to find these functions, very creative, very numerical. These functions were a little bit different. They were complete in that they didn't just have the one function that sat on the grid point. They had a whole tower of functions on each grid point with more and more momentum to sort of fill up phase space. And Wilson was very big on integrating out in phase space. So he wanted to have this tower of functions, and then you integrate them out. And then eventually you just have this sort of coarsest scale. And so here are some of the functions that he generated. This saw line here is the lowest, the main grid functions, but these other ones have more oscillations in them. And they have nice properties. Okay. But shortly after his preprint, that's when wavelet theory appeared. And that really sort of surpasses this in a nice way. Just to show sort of briefly, the wavelet theory also gives you sort of a towers of functions, but they're not all on the same distance scale. They get smaller and smaller as you get higher momentum, and that has lots of advantages. Okay, so let me give you a little primer on wavelet bases. I'll try to go through this quickly. So what is a wavelet basis? So let's start with a local lattice basis, some definitely defined thing. It could be these box functions that are, you know, this is a set of five box functions, each of which is zero outside. So we start with something, and we're going to sort of do an RG. So this is our starting point. Okay? Another starting point you could have are these sync functions, which are actually a nice starting point. But there's certain requirements you have for these starting functions. So that any, if you satisfy these, that sort of takes care of all the relevant variables in your RG. And so everything else is irrelevant, and you go to the same fixed point. Okay, so you start with a set of functions. And then what you do is you take the, let's look at these functions on a half scale. So this is a spacing of 1/2. We add functions from this scale up to make, in linear combinations, to make the functions at the top scale. So if you're just trying to do boxes and you want to just recreate boxes as your fixed point, you can just do this. Two boxes go into one. But normally these coefficients, this equation tells how the lower level creates the upper level. So the 2x means these are at the half scale. And you have these coefficients cj, and you add them up, okay, defining the functions higher up. And normally the number of cj's could be, you know, say, a dozen, or it could even be infinite, decaying off. And these set of coefficients cj define the scaling transformation. Okay, then you can iterate this to a fixed point. So you define these functions so that you define these coefficients so that the functions above maintain their orthogonality. So that's a strict constraint to keep the functions orthogonal. And you also want to capture the low momentum components. And that goes also into the choice of these C's. Okay. Okay, so if you choose these so carefully, for instance, you can get these Dobbschi's scaling functions. The lowest one that's pictured here has exactly 4 different C coefficients with analytic solutions. They're designed to capture the low momentum behavior by fitting low order polynomials. So you get a transformation matrix that takes some functions at the half scale and creates a set of functions at bigger scale. And this is not a unitary transformation. It's rectangular. So it's throwing away degrees of freedom like you expect in an RG. But you can carry this out to the fixed point. And so this is what the fixed point, this is the sort of wavelet scaling function. And it has all sorts of interesting properties, but also it's not very smooth. And so this directly is not very useful for our purposes. You don't want the kinetic energy associated with these little discontinuities. But you can do this to higher order. You can sort of make it fit more polynomials and get something that's progressively smoother. It's also not very symmetric, so that's not so desirable. Okay. Now, one of the characteristics of all of this is that it's throwing away degrees of freedom. So you can think of this as an RG, even in our usual sense. You think of it sort of as an RG-like thing in the space of functions. But if you define your Hamiltonian as defined by this basis, then that also makes it an RG for a Hamiltonian. Now, wavelet transformation is something that makes this unitary. So you don't just throw everything away. Here are the coefficients that keep the low energy degrees of freedom. And this particular combination, you can just sort of mentally dot these two things together, and you'll see that they're orthogonal. And so this actually keeps all degrees of freedom. And so the extra high energy degrees of freedom that you have left over are the wavelet. And so you can carry this to a fixed point. You just do the scaling transformation to the fixed point, and then you use that with another transformation to define these wavelet degrees of freedom. And so you get these fixed point functions. Okay, and that can be considered an overall unitary that doesn't throw anything away, but sort of sorts things into sort of low momentum and progressively higher momentum degrees of freedom. Okay, and so here's sort of the examples, first for the box, and then the sync function. This is the sync function is actually a fixed point in itself, and these are the two most extreme fixed points, and then it's the wavelet is this thing, which is orthogonal to that. Okay, and if you look at it at all levels, you see something that will start to look like a mirror. You do this wavelet transformation, and you get wavelets and scaling functions. And then you take the scaling functions up to the next level, and get higher order wavelets and scaling functions. Put the wavelets aside, keep scaling up the scaling functions. Okay? And that's what a wavelet transformation is. And if you start it the usual way, you start even at the lowest level at the fixed point so that it's scale invariant at all levels. But it's really just things in the space of functions. Okay? And so Xiaolang and others have used this to think about holographic mappings, where you think of these Ws as living in a higher dimensional space going up in the scale dimension. And you can think of just a unitary that starts with these degrees of freedom and just maps up into all Ws. Okay, then you have a lot of freedom in doing this. I'll just briefly mention these coiflets. You can put in different constraints and get functions that are nearly symmetric, that are much more reasonable to think of about putting on a grid point. Okay? And so these are much smoother than the Dauvichies functions. But these are also due to Dauvichies. Okay, so I want to so there are certain advantages in terms of the integrals that make these very nice, but let me skip that. Okay, so as I describe this in this RG framework, it makes you think, oh, this is very similar to Mira. And so that's sort of how we understand that. So we now think of Mira as sort of being, you know, one of the right ways to do real space RG. And the ingredients of sort of removing some of the local entanglement before you go to a higher level are very important. So suppose we just thought a thought experiment, how would we apply Mira to making this sort of ideal grid basis? Usually we think of Mira as applying to renormalizing a critical system at long wavelengths, but here we're trying to start at a fixed wavelength and go back to the continuum. And that's sort of equally useful. So we start with an infinitesimal grid and renormalize to a coarse grid. Okay, at short spacings, the kinetic energy is the dominant term. It's sort of an artificial energy scale from putting down a grid, but all the kinetic energy term scale is 1 over the grid spacing squared. So at very short distances, that's the dominant thing. And so what that does for you is that now you can just think of, oh, it's all the interactions don't matter at the lowest energy scales. It's just all kinetic energy. What matters is locality in real space and momentum space. And that's what the mirror would try to do. Okay. And this mirror, once you sort of think about it this way, you find out that the mirror would sort of, what you would come up with is just the wavelet transform. But of course, the wavelets were done earlier. And the mirrors that come up are highly restricted in that all of the tensors are restricted to be single particle objects. Okay, so here's an example of this. This is a diagram which you can think of as a low order mirror, or you can think of it as a wavelet transform, a wavelet circuit that gives you the lowest order Dauvichies that I just showed. And you can think of this, so when you do it in this fashion, you reinterpret the tensors not as many body unitaries, but as single particle unitaries or just matrix unitaries. And so you can think about this as just at the lowest level, say apply a creation operator, and then this gives you a sort of transform of those creation operators, just sort of, you know, adding them up with your gates looking like these 2x2 matrices. Okay. okay, and so this, if you think about the usefulness of this, this is probably much nicer than Wilson's Wannier functions. This is a major field of applied math, and it's very useful. Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand how this the kinetic energy non-relativistic. Sorry, your question dominates at small distances. How to match that with the CASP that you are describing?
Right.
That still.
Right. So you have to think about that. So if you go far enough, there'll be a regime where the cusps really shouldn't matter.
Oh.
Okay, and then if you sort of back away from that, then we really should be thinking about this as, okay, now we need to start thinking about, for some of the fine grid points as we work up near the cusp, we need to start doing something a little bit different. You know, and you can start, say, adapting your transformations near the cusps. Yeah, but that's a good point.
But anywhere else, the single particle description.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so so Glenn Evenly and I worked for a while on this wavelet mirror connection, and there were a couple of useful spin-offs that you can read about. There was one that was going in the direction of, can we use mirror ideas to make wavelets better? And then the other one was, can we use wavelet ideas to make mirror better? And I think both of them were sort of nice results. Okay, so traditional wavelets are unsymmetric. There's a theorem that says that if the wavelet transform has finite support, that it can't be symmetric. Okay, but it has loopholes, and in particular, there's a loophole that this theorem applies to scaling factor 2. So if you do scaling factor 3, you can construct very nice wavelets that are totally symmetric. And so here's a wavelet circuit for scaling factor 2, and here's one with scaling factor 3. It has swap gates, and it has these symmetric unitary gates with three sites. And this produces very nice wavelets that are completely symmetric. And it, by scaling by a factor of 3, you can construct these so that they, this is in momentum space. So you segregate things out into the lowest momentum, a central momentum, and a higher momentum. Okay. And there was some work that was done on this with scale factor 3 before. We don't think that they came up with that nice wavelets. We think that these are a little bit nicer, and certainly a much nicer sort of representation for thinking about this and thinking about symmetry. Okay, and then the second thing going in the other direction from using wavelet ideas to try to improve MIRA. A key idea is that the completeness characteristics that you attach to these wavelets are associated with the very lowest momentum fitting polynomials sort of thing. And so Glenn figured out how to very cleverly attach this to the Fermi level. You have a Fermi system. And I'm getting near the end. So so instead of optimizing a mirror, you don't minimize the energy directly. You try to optimize properties at sort of the Fermi surface. And this can give you nice mirror that are not functions of thousands of parameters, but can be written entirely in equations like these. Okay, so second to the last slide. We haven't carried out this sort of idealized program very far, but we've, you know, started on it. You can think of adapting the basis sets for the cusp. And you can think about it in different ways. So if I set up these grid functions, you know, to adapt to the ions, maybe I just use pseudopotentials. You can even think about using pseudopotentials for the electron-electron interaction. You can add localized functions to the grid basis and orthogonalize them. Or you can modify the angles that are used to define a wavelet transformation to adapt to the core singular behavior. Okay, so there's lots of choices and needs to be sorted through. Okay, so last slide. So idealized grids for tensor networks, where do we stand? This is sort of a progress report. Okay, so we have still not implemented any full 3D version of this sort of optimal grid behavior, grid construction. So for DMRG, this slice basis approach, we think, is real progress for chain-type systems. And so that's what we're mostly focusing on, and Miles will tell about that. And as we think about improving this slice basis set approach, some of these ideas that I've talked about we'll need to use. So to do larger Z than the hydrogen we've been doing, we need to integrate out the cores better, and so we need to try to integrate some of these ideas in 1D where it's an easier easier format. And then we hope that this eventually leads to practical PEPS calculations for large 3D systems. Okay, so thank you.
the request of how pedagogical talk work is in this case. So questions.
So are you assuming all time that courts are like fixed? And if this is true, well, how realistic is this? I mean, how would it modify basically the electoral effects if you allow also courts to know the movement of the...
So you have to do this very carefully. But we have the example of the quantum chemists. So you need to fix the core degrees of freedom as the atoms move around. And it's important, you know, for the applications to let the atoms move around and to get consistent properties, energies as a function of the positions, or to get potential functions. So what they do is they attach the functions to the atom, and that does almost everything you need for some calculations, or you can use a pseudo-potential. One of the other things that they do, though, is that if you just take the Hartree-Fock level calculation, and then for the core degrees of freedom, the 1s, et cetera, you freeze the Hartree-Fock, then that gives you, in effect, sort of a pseudo-potential that keeps everything totally stable. And so that's a sort of good starting point. We can imagine starting with Hartree-Fock and then freezing those core orbitals. And then that sort of makes them a single particle degree of freedom. And it misses some correlation, but you can just sort of ignore that. Yeah. So it seems like this is a way you can proceed in a sensible fashion. Yeah.
Yeah, if we could work in second quantization and say, we had a big quantum computer just laying around that we can use, would that take care of like this cusp? Because this Coulomb potential is kind of just like key.
I think the entire bulk of my talk, I hadn't really thought about it this way, but if you're thinking of some of these estimates of how a quantum computer could attack the quantum chemistry problem, I think it goes straight over. So when they do the estimates, the good estimates will take into account, put it in a basis, do this VIJKL. There's a whole lot of terms. It scales badly. So if you could set the problem up on these idealized grids with a lot fewer terms, that would translate into fewer circuits and gates and qubits. So everything just, and the second, I've sort of gone back and forth between first quantized and second quantized. That's just a detail of how you write down the equations to make them easiest to read, but it's all in there.
The traditional band structure theory for solids, several pseudo potentials are used. They are more like variational functions. So is your method that you described giving a way to give them, because normally they are guessed like Muffington potential or some chemical sort of potential. So are you providing a systematic way to?
Well, this is vaporware, I guess. There's no real calculations done. But if you think about the, 99% of the pseudo potentials that are used, they're used for density functional theory. And they may be quite crude and inappropriate for sort of going well beyond that in terms of correlations. And so for the most part, I've assumed that we couldn't quite trust those. And the quantum chemists, I hear, have some better ones, but I haven't quite gotten into finding out exactly how those works. And I've also thought from the point of view, if we had to design one from scratch, how would we do that? But we don't really have anything that's established yet. So,
any other questions? If not, let's stand still again.